We really, we thought a lot about kind of who to bring as keynotes. Lana is somebody who really embodies, I think, in her practice, this idea of kind of working across kind of critical and making practice and kind of working as a researcher and a writer. She has a recent book, and she's also been making films for a long time, since the 90s. So somebody who I think really embodies the kinds of things we're interested in thinking about here. We were very lucky to get to see kind of in a very early moment, Lana's new film, The Cancer Journals Revisited, which will be premiering officially in June at BAM Cinema Fest in Brooklyn. So those of you in New York, look out for that. It's a really, really beautiful and also important film. And then for us also, it was kind of important for us to think about within this kind of against story, beyond story, kind of thinking with and oppositionally and around story, to really think about kind of critical disability and illness as this really important category that kind of we tend to want to storify culturally and kind of think around, you know, survivor narratives, illness narratives, battle narratives, kind of all of these narratives and stories. But that really ultimately kind of chronic illness in particular is this kind of category that really defies and is incommensurate with kind of story and storytelling. So we're very, very happy to have Lana here to talk about her work. So she'll be speaking for a while, and then we've also invited our colleague in the anthropology department at UCSC, Megan Moody, who's over there, who's associate professor of anthropology. Megan will be in conversation with Lana after her keynote, and then also in conversation with all of you. So welcome, Lana. We're really happy to have you.
Thank you for that wonderful introduction. And thank you all for being here bright and early for the first talk of the morning. Thank you so much to Irene Lustig and Irene Gustafson for this invitation. It's a really a pleasure and an honor to be here. And thank you to all the people working so hard to make this event happen. I want to just acknowledge and thank Irene Lustig for her early support of the film I'm going to be discussing today. I so appreciate the ways in which she lives out her feminist solidarity. She was shooting Yours and Sisterhood at the same time as I was shooting my film, and I see our films in conversation with each other. The act of reading, of thinking on screen, is something I think we're both fascinated by. My film, like hers, enunciates words written in a historical past, observing the thought process activated in the present moment. I believe we both aim to orchestrate a collective voice, one that I will propose is paradoxically both singular and plural. I'd like to expand upon the potential of such a voice for what might be a radical politics and poetics. To respond to the prompt of a symposium on the poetics and politics of documentary, to take up a resistance to story, something I feel has been a near lifelong mantra for me, I turn to the figure to whom I have now turned for nearing a decade. Black feminist poet Audre Lorde's essay, "Poetry is Not a Luxury," begins with these words. The quality of light by which we scrutinize our lives has direct bearing upon the product which we live and upon the changes which we hope to bring about through these lives. Later, she continues, in the forefront of our move toward change, there is only our poetry to hint at possibility made real. Our poems formulate the implications of ourselves, what we feel within and dare make real. I want to take this opportunity to dwell on these passages and to think about the implications of ourselves and what we dare make real in relation to my most recent film, The Cancer Journals Revisited, which seeks to perform a close reading of Lorde's memoir of her breast cancer experience through 27 readers and through my own breast cancer experience 30 years after Lorde's. If documentary is not centrally driven by story, then what can it be driven by? Poetic nonfiction film, rather than follow the lead or compulsion to story might find itself more in common with poetry. Poetry grants us that quality of light by which we scrutinize our lives. Poetry is a necessity for examining ourselves and our worlds and our embeddedness in our worlds. Poetry points to the ways we can imagine new worlds. Here and elsewhere, Lord describes life as having texture. Life itself is a material form that poetry casts a light upon. Poetic nonfiction film carries precisely the power of illumination. It follows the impulse to scrutinize, and scrutiny is intimate with whatever it comes in contact with, whether that is objects in the world or oneself. I have never called myself a documentarian, nor my films documentaries, unless forced to. Lord's definition of poetry is closer to where I would like to align my films, possibility made real. And so in this sense, while documentary is not a category that my films fit easily into, my work bears a relation to a central tenet of documentary, that is, a relation to the real. This discomfort I have with the term documentary is shared by many others, Jill Godmillow for one. In How Real is the Reality in Documentary Film, a conversation she had with Anne Louise Shapiro in 1997, Godmillow suggests an alternate term, films of edification, calling so-called documentarians edifiers. In unpacking what it is that edifying films do, or to use Bill Nichols's term, which they refer to as well, how such films are instrumental, they make a critique of the tidy, closed story. Foremost, for Godmillow, is the need to acknowledge interpretation, rather than to pretend that the document is mere description. To put the technique of filmmaking at the service of ideas, and to engage the audience in a discussion about the ideological construction of representation. She notes that there are many, many ways to do this. As you all know, Alexandra Juhasz and Alisa LeBeau echo the varied, multifarious, really endless ways in which films that make real our possibilities can be rendered. In their community-based manifesto, Beyond Story, which has set the stage for this year's symposium, they list disruptive, dialogic, nonlinear, creative, as but a few of the options that go beyond story. They too underscore that the forms that some of us call documentary, quote, emerge from and shape ideological assumptions, end quote. We saw this in the video they showed yesterday, and somehow I had recalled that I read that quote about ideological assumptions from their text in the video. However, against my memory, in fact, I answered the call of this one. Forms are cultural, political, and ethical commitments in their own right. We believe there is a social obligation to challenge besieged forms and to celebrate the process of finding form in the formless and formlessness in the form. The manifesto goes on to say, and this resonated for Shindu as well, so we saw it in her talk, cameras film things as they are happening. People experience the world in real time, but also in felt time. Reality often feels unmoored, confusing, unstorified, especially in crisis. It is this unstorified crisis that motivates my recent film, The Cancer Journals Revisited. Who but a poet, a staunchly political, activist-oriented poet, could address the pervasive, multi-layered crisis of cancer in our times and how it penetrates every level of social life and death and does so unequally. I was not driven to tell my story of cancer, nor expressly to collect other individuals' stories about their cancer experiences, although I did to some degree, but to ask what this text, which uses cancer as a way of investigating the deep wounds of racism, sexism, ableism, and environmental degradation, means for us today. And to call into question who this us is and can be. To call attention to the formation of an us in its making. Who are we? Who can we claim to be? Between 2016 and 2018, I invited people from a range of backgrounds, ages, ethnicities, and sexual and gendered identities to read aloud excerpts from Lord's 1980 memoir, The Cancer Journals, which could also rightly be called a manifesto, and to reflect upon its meaning in our contemporary moment. I wanted to preserve each person's individuality and yet for them to speak in a collective voice. Extending from a single authorial voice, each of the readers respond to the text in distinctly personal ways. While their collective action of speech amounts, to my mind, to a political act, the readers add a vocal and embodied dimension. In describing Danielle Huillier and Jean-Marie Straub's films, Barton Bigg writes of their work, each film respects the form of the text it presents, drawing it into sharp clarity by treating it not as a transparent technical element, as material for a story, but as a text, a material document. Their films record their own confrontations with the text, the challenge made to the text by its setting, for instance, in a contemporary landscape. The films document the interaction between the original form and content of the text and the form of the film in which the text is cited or recited. I can't think of a more fitting description of my aspirations in The Cancer Journals Revisited. So now I'll play the first 10 minutes of the film, and the film is a feature-length 98-minute film. And this is the first 10 minutes.
Nobody wanted to die on the way, caught between ghosts of whiteness and the real water. None of us wanted to leave our bones on the way to salvation. Three planets to the left a century of light years ago. Our spices are separate and particular, but our skins sing in complementary keys. At a quarter to eight, meantime, we were telling the same stories over and over.
Broken down gods survive in the crevasses and mud pots of every beleaguered city, where it is obvious there are too many bodies to cart to the ovens or gallows, and our uses have become more important than our silence. After the fall, too many empty cases of blood to bury or burn, there will be nobody left to listen. And our labor has become more important than our silence. Our labor has become more important than our silence.
I'm standing here as a black lesbian poet, and the meaning of all that waits upon the fact that I am alive at all, and I had not thought to be. Less than 2 months ago, I was told by two doctors, one female and one male, that I would have to have breast surgery, and that there was a 60 to 80% chance that the tumor was malignant. Between that telling and the actual surgery, there was a 3-week period of the agony of an involuntary reorganization of my entire life. This is a situation I know faced by many women, by some of you perhaps here now. But some of what I experienced during that time has helped to elucidate for me much of what I feel concerning the transformation of silence into language and action. In becoming forcibly and essentially aware of what mortality meant for me, of what I wished and wanted for my life, however short it might be, priorities and omissions became very strongly etched in a merciless light, and what I most regretted were my silences. Of what had I ever been afraid?
To question or to speak as I believed could have meant pain or death, but we all hurt in so many different ways all the time, and pain will either change or end. Death, on the other hand, is the final silence. I was going to die.
If not sooner than later.
Whether or not I had ever spoken myself.
My silences had not protected me. Your silence will not protect you. But for every real word spoken, for every attempt I had ever made to speak those truths for which I am still seeking, I'd make contact with other women. While we examined the words to fit a world in which we all believed, bridging our differences. Within those weeks of acute fear came the knowledge. Within the war we were all waging with the forces of death, subtle and otherwise, conscious or not. I am not only a casualty. I am also a warrior.
What are the words you did not yet have?
You did not yet have.
What is it that you need to say? What are the tyrannies that you swallow day after day in an attempt to make your own until you are sickened and die of them eventually, still in silence? Perhaps for some of you here now, I am the face of one of your fears. Because I am a woman, because I am black, because I'm a lesbian, because I am myself, a black woman warrior poet, doing her work, come to ask you, are you doing yours?
Solana, I'm going to read this, page 21. And of course, I am afraid. You can hear it in my voice. Because the transformation of silence into language and action is an act of self-revelation, and that always seems fraught with danger. But my daughter, when I told her of our topic and my difficulty with it, said, "Tell them about how you're never really a whole person if you remain silent, because there's always that little one piece of you that wants to be spoken out. And if you keep ignoring it, it gets madder and madder and hotter and hotter. And if you don't speak it out, one day it will just up and punch you in the mouth." Well, I remember that conversation. It's great to read that. It's great to read that. I am not the warrior my mother was, though. I recognize the truth of those words. When the stakes are high, and when there's an essential truth that needs to be spoken, I think that that's one of the lessons of my mother that I carry with me.
Each of us is here now because in one way or another, we share a commitment to language and to the power of language and to the reclaiming of that language which has been made to work against us. In the transformation of silence into language and action, it is vitally necessary for each one of us to establish or examine her function in that transformation and to recognize her role as vital within that transformation. It is necessary to teach by living and speaking those truths which we believe and know beyond understanding. Because in this way alone we can survive, by taking part in a process of life that is creative and continuing, that is growth. And where the words of women are crying to be heard, we must, each of us, recognize our responsibility to seek those words out, to read them and share them and examine them in their pertinence to our lives. That we not hide behind the mockeries of separations that have been imposed upon us and which so often we accept as our own.
The whole cancer experience for my mom crystallized that idea that courage is not the absence of fear, but the action in the face of fear, that fear, which by nature is paralyzing, not be allowed to persist in being paralyzing. The stuff that she wanted to say, she felt these things were incredibly powerful, whether it was her work in South Africa, her work in the cancer journals. And when she talks about the sustenance of her community of women and how they didn't all look one way. In the breast cancer process, although my mom had always been sustained by a community of women who didn't all look one way, now that there was this additional battle, not just on the breast cancer front, but also on the political front, because I think it sharpened her political focus and it sharpened her urgency around her political focus, that she was very clear that those battle lines would break down along sometimes class lines, but not even necessarily, because there were folks of different classes who might engage in this battle too. Basically, our comrades are where we find them. That makes us, and it always makes us, a stronger fighting power. It makes us more dangerous.
In making a claim for edification rather than for an uncomplicated narrative of truth, Godmillow insists on her films producing an audience of active intellectual participants, expressly not a community. Lord, on the other hand, was committed to celebrating her community of fellow survivors. And I don't mean cancer survivors or only cancer survivors, but those who, as she puts it, were never meant to survive. But she was equally committed to preserving her varied self-identities as a poet, a mother, a lesbian, a Black woman, a warrior. Her embrace of community is strategic and political. She is intent on recognizing the value of Black and brown bodies, poor bodies, disabled bodies, migrant and immigrant bodies, gender nonconforming bodies, and this recognition requires a communal effort. The oscillation and ultimate codependence between community and the individual can be discerned in Lord's typewritten drafts of the cancer journals, which are held in the Spelman College archive. You can see evidence here of Lord's edits through tense black pencil redacting and ballpoint pen scribbles, redacting key words. Here a page appears from the folder BC, A Black Lesbian Feminist Experience, Part 3, Power versus Prosthesis, in which the third person she is replaced by the first person. By the first person I. Lord initially writes, "The implications of that for the life and the quality and texture of that life is something every woman in this situation should be encouraged to face. She has already faced her own death, whether or not she acknowledges it, and developed the strength survival has given her." Lord changes this to, "The implication of that for my life and the quality and texture of that life is something every woman in this situation should be encouraged to face. I have already faced my own death, whether or not I acknowledged it. I needed now to develop the strength survival had given me." I discussed this critical passage with filmmaker and scholar Toby Lee in an upcoming contribution to Millennium Film Journal. Although I had gravitated toward this passage amongst the stacks of Lord's manuscripts, the significance of her copy edits hadn't yet revealed their importance to me until Toby pointed them out. As she writes about the texture of life, Lord pieces together her words, literally cutting and taping her pages together, recalling the surgical slice and sutures, and also bringing to mind, for me, cinematic cuts, splice, and cinematic sutures. In these edits, Lord insists upon making the personal political and the political personal. She makes a public claim and takes responsibility for her life, her feared death, and the strength it takes her to survive both. If a first-person plural is foundational for the makings of a community for Lord, the I must be revealed and risked in order for a we to emerge. This emergent community is purposefully grounded in individual differences, which Lord fiercely protected. The Cancer Journals Revisited takes Lord's lead in using the mode of individuated self-revelation as a path toward community building. In the film, all but two of the readers appear on camera alone. The individuality of each reader is preserved while their voices accumulate into a communal oration. The film thereby hopes to posit and enact the self as collectivity. The tension between she and I that produces a we is recapitulated in the Cancer Journal's Revisited as a tension between the we of the readers who are held together by a subject I, who is also an object, an it. This it might be attributed to illness, cancer in particular, or the objectified body. Lord instructs, the transformation of silence into language and action is an act of self-revelation, and that always seems fraught with danger. My film takes up the obligation towards self-revelation that Lord poses as a political practice. Because self-revelation is an ongoing process, the subject position in my film is neither closed nor totalizing. It is a permeable, plural subject that is loosely held together by me. Beyond this distributed self-expression, the Cancer Journal's Revisited is primarily a work of self-revelation for me, the filmmaker. The readers function as stand-ins for me, a means for myself to be pluralized, to be both individual and personal, as well as collectively political. While my voice is never audible in the film, it appears as text throughout, and I understand it and believe it is felt as the guiding force behind the film, in tandem with Lord's. This film answers Lord's call to do my work, to gather up all my fragmentary identities and to put them together towards some kind of collective action, to dare to reveal my endangered selves for the prospect of making real a future in which the very idea of community could be possible. Self-revelation is a form of self-scrutiny. Self-scrutiny can be, very likely is, painful. Like a blade making an incision, it is, as Lord notes, fraught with danger. I occupy a distinct position in the film vis-a-vis its other participants. I expose myself to the camera in an effort to make myself at least as vulnerable as those I have invited to directly address its lens and the audience. But only my flesh is laid bare on the screen. And I'm not including those moments, really, in the clips I've chosen to show today because I'm protective of making visible those parts of myself without the rest of the film to shield me from your scrutiny. In the film, I work against the voyeuristic, pornographic demand to deliver images that authenticate suffering, mine or others. Self-revelation is a means of bearing witness. But through the course of the film, this labor is borne by both the viewer and the viewed. I've spent a lifetime as suspicious of claims to community as I have of demands for story. I hope to propose through the Cancer Journal's Revisited, or what I hope to propose, is the idea that the self is both individual and collective, that selfhood might be considered plural. And the very prospect of survival depends upon care for that fragile plurality. The form of the Cancer Journal's Revisited resembles that of the Japanese poetic form, renga, which translates into English as linked poem. Linked poems originated over 700 years ago and were the product of collaboration, as poets would write in pairs or small groups, taking turns composing alternating stanzas. I was introduced to renga through another poet who has indelibly marked me and influences this film in unseen ways. Eve Kosofsky Sedgwick, better known as a literary theorist and grand dame of queer theory, had a passion for poetry and Buddhism that led me to an understanding of life itself taking the form of renga. Life is like renga because living is a collaborative project. Perhaps no more so than when one is ill or disabled. Or rather, when one is ill or disabled, the necessary codependency humans have with other human beings is brought into relief. I wanted to bring this collaborative project of living and of speaking for the sake of survival to fruition in a film to preserve the collective self-care that these trying times demand. call it a war cry issued from 27 speakers, mostly women of color, young and old, of differing health status, sexual orientations, racial and gender identities. So now I'll play another 10-minute clip from a little later in the film.
Growing up fat, black, female, and almost blind in America requires so much surviving that you have to learn from it or die. The next day, when I was still not thinking too much, a kindly woman from Reach for Recovery came in to see me with a very upbeat message and a little prepared packet containing a soft sleep bra and a wad of lamb's wool pressed into a pale pink breast-shaped pad. She was 56 years old, she told me proudly. She was also a woman of admirable energies who clearly would uphold and defend to the death those structures of a society that had allowed her a little niche to shine in. Her message was, "You are just as good as you were before because you can look exactly the same. Lamb's wool now, then a good prosthesis as soon as possible, and nobody will ever know the difference." But what she said was, "You'll never know the difference." And she lost me right there because I knew sure as hell I'd know the difference. "Look at me," she said, opening her trim powder blue man-tailored jacket and standing before me in a tight blue sweater, a gold embossed locket of no mean dimension provocatively nestling between her two considerable breasts. "Now can you tell which is which?" I admitted that I could not. In her tight foundation garment and stiff, uplifting bra, both breasts looked equally unreal to me. I looked away thinking, I wonder if there are any black lesbian feminists in Reach for Recovery. It's like something struck me just now, but now I'm trying to remember what it was. You know, I think it was that, just Audre Lorde's a poet and obviously picked these words very carefully. And what stood out for me this time was man-tailored jacket and just this, this cloak of patriarchy that this woman is wearing, even though she's, like, displaying her large breasts, one of which was some kind of prosthesis or reconstruction. And there's something about that that was just so powerful, hiding the reality of the pain and the suffering. There's a lot about the breast cancer industry that I feel is very insulting to women's experience. A woman's quote-unquote beauty or attractiveness or that surface reality is a big part of that insult, I think. That idea that you give a black woman a pink prosthesis, you know, and that's part of sort of cancer in itself as this metaphor in this country. Like, there isn't a lot of acknowledgement of the different experiences of cancer and why black women die of breast cancer more than white women, why there's such a high rate of cancer among poor people. If you look at something like Love Canal, which was a long time ago now, but the amount of cancer that was connected to these chemical plants and their dumping, and so how it's higher depending on whether you can have access to just a clean environment, whether that's physical or psychically, and the stress related. And so there are all these nuances to cancer that don't get talked about when you're talking about a breast cancer march. Not even that long ago, something that was whispered, like couldn't even be said aloud, the metaphor that cancer is in our society and what it means and the fear around it, and the stories around it, and especially breast cancer and all the pinkness, I think that's what I was kind of keeping at bay. It's been a huge part of my life. I've been diagnosed 3 times now, and it definitely informs my life every day. It's changed me physically, as I was mentioning. But there's something about it becoming the story of my life that I'm afraid of.
I ached to talk to women about the experience I had just been through and about what might be to come and how they were doing it and how they had done it. but I needed to talk with women who shared at least some of my major concerns and beliefs and visions, who shared at least some of my language. And this lady, admirable though she might be, did not. I was thinking, what's it like to be making love to a woman and have only one breast brushing against her? I thought, how will we fit so perfectly together ever again? I thought, I wonder if our lovemaking had anything to do with it. I thought, what will it be like making love to me? Will she still find my body delicious? After she left, assuring me that Reach for Recovery was always ready to help, I examined the package she had left behind. The lamb's wool form was the strangest part of the collection. I examined it in its blush pink nylon envelope with a slightly darker apex and shaped like a giant slipper shell. I shuddered at its grotesque dryness. I pulled the thing out of my bra and my thin pajama top settled back against the flattened surface on the right side of the front of me. I looked at the large, gentle curve my left breast made under the pajama top, a curve that seemed even larger now that it stood by itself. I looked strange and uneven and peculiar to myself, but somehow, ever so much more myself, and therefore so much more acceptable than I looked with that thing stuck inside my clothes. For not even the most skillful prosthesis in the world could undo that reality or feel the way my breast had felt. And either I would love my body one-breasted now or remain forever alien to myself. With the cancer sometimes, especially the chemo, you feel like the cure might kill you. You know what I mean? It's just like the equivalent of drinking liquid Drano. After being in chemo for a month, coming home, and my scent changed so my dog didn't recognize me. And the dog actually thinking a stranger had come in the house and barking and wanting me to leave. So feeling all by myself in that. It's like, what's wrong with me? Even my puppy doesn't love me anymore. It's like how you have to get to know yourself all over again and the hard work in that. I tended to always be thinking about other people before I would be thinking about myself. And the weird time that I did get to think only about me was when I was having chemo and radiation. That was like my really scary, but my quiet time. One of the things that I always thought of when I was having the chemo is that that's the time when you get to see the nicest part of the hospital. So we were like in this beautiful room that I just didn't even know existed. It was Weill Cornell, and it was like this circular room, and it had gorgeous sunlight. It was really ironic, right? It was so beautiful, even though we were going through this ugliest process. And there would be books there that you could look at, and all of the books were these happy, sunshiny, like, I beat cancer, and my life is so much better books. I wasn't interested in any of that. And I remember my oncologist saying, you know, you're now starting your 5-year window, and if you can get through that. And I just looked at him and I said, thank you. And he says, aren't you happy? And I said, you know, the thing is, I am happy to be in remission and I'm grateful for all the work that you did for me, but I still don't have enough money in the bank. My apartment is still too small. I don't love my job. There are many things that I need to change about my life, and now I'm just too tired to do any of it, so I just am sitting here. I said, and maybe instead of all those happy books that you have about, you know, when people enter remission, how amazing their life is, maybe you should have somebody write a book that goes, all the shit that you could barely deal with before is still waiting for you, and now you have to figure out how to get all this poison out of your system and have enough energy to make it work.
On the fourth day, the other drain was removed. I found out that my lymph nodes had shown no sign of spread of the cancer. And my doctor said that I could go home on the following day since I was healing so rapidly. I looked down at the surgical area as he changed the dressing, expecting it to look like a ravaged and pitted battlefield of some major catastrophic war. Looking down now on the right side of me, I could see the curve of the side of my stomach across this new and changed landscape. I thought, I wonder how long it was before the Dahomeyan girl Amazons could take their changed landscape for granted. Actually, this passage, what that brings to me is that I was not just fighting the cancer at that time, but I was also fighting my solitude. Because during my cancer treatment, I was living on my own. My whole family lives in Brazil, and it was really hard to cope. So after a while, and many battles came with cancer as well. I almost became homeless, I lost my job, so was many battles inside this battle.
In the equation of filmmaking with storytelling, what often goes missing, or at least has been submerged, is a critical inquiry into the presumptions of good storytelling. Good storytelling traditionally follows a heroic journey that makes a dramatic arc that climaxes and then resolves. Life bears little resemblance to a story well told, at least not life as I know it. The compulsion towards storytelling plays a leading role in another genre besides documentary or even dramatic film, that of the illness narrative, as Irene brought up in the introduction. Since Arthur Frank wrote his influential book, The Wounded Storyteller, much attention has been paid to the need that besets many patients to make sense of their illness. It is a human quality to strive to construct some meaning out of suffering. Eve Sedgwick, who suffered from breast cancer, was a longtime AIDS advocate, and she mused, how permeable the identity of survivor is to the undiminishing currents of risk, illness, mourning, and defiance. Sedgwick relished the first-person plural pronoun, we, describing it as permeable, a rich mesh of relationality that, it, if not equal to love, at least occasioned it. We is the subject position from which I have proffered the Cancer Journal's Revisited, and which I hope to engender in its viewing and engagement. A critical community of individuals collected within this permeable relational net, the we of the Cancer Journal's Revisited attempt to make an occasion for love, and in doing so, to open the prospect for a more welcoming, just, and sustainable world. Like a life-threatening diagnosis, the film asks for a reevaluation of priorities, posing the question of what kind of life is worth living and what kind of world is worth fighting for. In discussing science fiction writer Octavia Butler's awe-inspiring world-making Xenogenesis trilogy, Toby Lee, who teaches at NYU, asked some of her PhD students if they had themselves had any experiences of world-making. One of them, Daryl Metter, who had worked with me on my film, replied that the production of The Cancer Journal's Revisited was to her a process of world-making. This anecdote is utterly gratifying to me because one of my highest ambitions is to engage, especially my embattled comrades, in a project of making a livable world. In its paradox as both singular and plural, perhaps the voice of the Cancer Journal's Revisited may have the potential to activate the paradox of politics that Bonnie Honig describes and to which Pooja Rangan refers in her analysis of human rights speech acts and the role they play within participatory documentary aesthetics. Such acts, as Rangan argues, quote, appeal to an imagined community of humanity that does not yet exist, but that they hope to remake in their own excluded image, end quote. I concur with Rangan that such speech acts that make claims to humanity, either on behalf of others or on behalf of one's self, are never immediately or completely legible, and I am precisely drawn to the potentiality that inheres in such incompletion and illegibility. As a speech act, my film strives to render its plural subject, my and other selves, legible only insofar as viewers, listeners recognize the limits of that legibility. I, we, they, it, this multiple pronouned object takes pride in and maintains its right to opacity. Rangan concludes her critique of the humanitarian impulse in documentary by detecting a trace, a potential within the very structure of the interpolative hail that seeks to bring a community of others into the fold of humanity. In giving the other the gift of documentary, she notes, the interpolative hail may be returned as a counter hail that, quote, interpolates humans as that which is excluded from the definition of human, that is, as not yet as not yet normatively human, end quote. I count myself a person who wishes to reject the normatively human, who wishes to make a claim for myself and fellow sister outsiders who might stand together as not normatively human. And I admit to an attraction to the appeal of imagining a community that we can remake in our own excluded image, in our own excluded images. The last clip I'll show comes towards the end of the film. And it's another 10-minute clip.
One of the key interventions of this text was her refusal to allow cancer to remain at the level of the individual, and that concern to be kept in private, and to really draw the links, jumping across scales from the body and the breast to government agencies, to draw the links between individual experiences of disease and the kinds of policies that make exposures that cause disease possible, which continues to be a fight that we are engaged in today, particularly in this moment as we look forward to what might be the dismantling of the EPA and of other regulatory agencies. So Audre Lorde calls upon us to understand our health, to identify those things that are harmful and that disproportionately harm some bodies more than others. And so one of the things that Audre Lorde continues to help us to think about are the real effects, the material effects of the kinds of experiences we have in the world, in addition to the kinds of exposures we have at the hands of corporate and political bodies that leave us vulnerable to those kinds of toxicities. So, for example, as a Black lesbian feminist mother poet warrior, right, and I think I might have missed one or two of her descriptors of herself, she's someone who experiences viscerally and in a somatic way what it is to confront racism, sexism, homophobia, various forms of misogyny, but also identifies the food that she's eating or has access to, right? We all have different kinds of access to different kinds of health-giving or health-destroying substances. As part of the space from which her cancer is generated. You know, in addition to being an incredible intervention to say I refuse to, one, be blamed for my cancer diagnosis because of bad habits, I also refuse to make this an experience that I internalize and wound myself for. So instead, I will care for my body in a particular kind of way, and I will care for my spirit, but I will also care for the kinds of things I learn and think about with others. So I think the move from self-blame to self-care is both about her individual body, but also about the bodies of the other people with whom she claims political, personal, intimate relationship. The part that strikes me is the protection of all the information we can acquire. She says we have a responsibility to learn more about these diagnoses, learn more about these conditions and their origins, so that we can hold the real perpetrators responsible for making it possible for so many of us to suffer in this way.
It is easier to demand happiness than to clean up the environment. As if happiness alone can protect us from the results of profit madness. Was I wrong to be working so hard against the oppression afflicting women and Black people? Was I in error to be speaking out against our silent passivity and the cynicism of a mechanized and inhuman civilization that is destroying our earth and those who live upon it? Was I really fighting the spread of radiation, racism, woman slaughter, chemical invasion of our food, pollution of our environment, the abuse and psychic destruction of our young, merely to avoid dealing with my first and greatest responsibility, to be happy? In this disastrous time, when little girls are still being stitched shut between their legs, when victims of cancer are urged to court more cancer in order to be attractive to men, when 12-year-old Black boys are shot down in the street at random by uniformed men who are cleared of any wrongdoing, what depraved monster could possibly be always happy? The only really happy people I have ever met are those of us who work against these deaths with all the energy of our living, recognizing the deep and fundamental unhappiness with which we are surrounded, while at the same time fighting to keep from being submerged by it. But if the achievement and maintenance of perfect happiness is the only secret of a physically healthy life in America, then it is a wonder that we are not all dying of a malignant society. Audre Lorde is raging against this very American idea that we must always be happy. We must whitewash our lives. And when I say whitewash, I mean that literally, figuratively, racially, and metaphorically. It negates any discussion about suffering. And suffering is a part of living. All this pain is just a vital part of life. To place happiness at the top of a hierarchy that is really an illusion does not do us any good in terms of being thinking progressive human beings that want to transform and support each other as we move through this difficult life. And anytime you tell someone who's had cancer that they should be grateful to be alive or they should be happy every day, you are misunderstanding what it means to be diagnosed with cancer. One of the things Audre Lorde also talks about in this passage is about environmental disasters, contamination, pollution, how these are all of the factors that are creating cancers for us, in us. And the cancer that I was diagnosed with, lymphoma, they tell you have it because you were exposed to some sort of toxic release. And your genetic composition combined with your exposure to this toxic substance, which no one can define and no one ever knows the answer to, is the reason you got this lymphoma. 2 years after I was in remission, my cancer came back. And the second treatment I went through was a very progressive and relatively new type of treatment. Went to the hospital. I went into that room that had signs all over it that said, highly radioactive, do not enter. But you're in this place that no one else is allowed to go into because it is toxic. And yet you're there having this almost like the science fiction drug dropped into your body while everyone else is behind the glass watching you. When you find yourself there, it's indescribable. You understand that you are in this place that is so dangerous that no human is supposed to tread. But you are there, naked, with just a sheet, you know, covering your skin. You understand in a very deep and profound way that you're different than other humans. And that is so unfathomable to comprehend how that really affects you internally and affects your ability to still feel human. Maybe you're not even human anymore. That goes so far beyond being happy, as Audre Lorde rails against in this passage. So after that treatment, I was not allowed to be around children for a month. I was not allowed to go on the subway. I was not allowed to sleep with my partner. I was not supposed to use the same toilet that we had at one bathroom apartment. So there was this whole flushing process that had to happen multiple times every time I used the bathroom. I was supposed to throw out my utensils every time after I used them and throw them in a separate garbage bag than the rest of the garbage. I got a Geiger counter to check how radioactive I was, and it was off the charts. And that otherizing, that separation of you from the rest of the world is very hard to come back from.
To conclude, I thought I would attempt to devise a Renga by revisiting and linking some of the key phrases that emerged from the excerpts I have shown of the Cancer Journals Revisited. We were telling the same stories over and over and over. What are the words you do not yet have? What is it that you need to say? There's something about it becoming the story of my life that I'm afraid of. Many battles came with cancer. I almost became homeless. I lost my job. So there were many battles inside of this battle. You understand that you are different from other humans. Maybe you're not even human anymore. The nearly four decades since the publication of the Cancer Journals have been characterized not so much by stasis as a Sisyphean return. What gains in civil rights that have been attained between 1980 and 2019 have since been rolled back. If HIV/AIDS has become a managed chronic illness for privileged North Americans and Europeans, it remains a scourge amongst the urban poor in both the global North and South, most devastatingly in sub-Saharan Africa. While breast reconstruction is customarily offered by health insurance and reconstruction has become so technologically perfected as to grace such beauty icons as Angelina Jolie, health insurance remains a privilege of the economically advantaged, and African American women die of breast cancer at the highest rates of any ethnic group in this country. Black boys are still routinely murdered on the street by police officers. The reader in the last clip I showed might easily have been talking about Trayvon Martin or Tamir Rice or Michael Brown and not Clifford Glover, to whom Lord was likely referring. Returning to the Cancer Journals is to draw strength from its insights and also to gain traction from the friction that is generated as it brushes against the present moment. This friction is not unlike that of an original brushing against its translation, as Walter Benjamin elaborates. Benjamin asserts that a translation is a means of coming to terms with the foreignness of language. Transferring this to filmmaking practice, I understand filmmaking as a way of coming to terms with the foreignness of others and the foreignness of myself. According to Benjamin, the translation issues from the afterlife of the original, transforming it. I'm struck by two other afterlives that are relevant to my concerns. Patrick Anderson narrates the autobiography of his disease from the collective viewpoint of his bacterial infection. The illness that rendered him in pieces could not be returned as a singular or totalizing story, but haunted him as a counter-hail from the non-normatively human, or better, the assemblage of human, not human, that he, they, has, have, become, is becoming. Anderson, including the bacteria, medication, and prostheses that will perpetually cohabitate his body, ruminates upon what he names the afterlife of illness. In the afterlife of illness, the illusion of a unitary self is destroyed. In its wake, the self is pluralized. It is undestroyed, as Roxane Gay phrases it. And finally, Sadia Hartman powerfully resurrects the afterlife of slavery, which lives on in empty archives and untold stories. From Anderson and Hartman, we learn that stories of the broken must themselves be broken open in the sense of pushing back on the coded and conventional logics of proper storytelling. Hartman calls forth a dream of the world house, which shelters the common dreams of fugitives, refugees, and migrants. This world house is the result of collective world building. From it can issue counter-hails, to which Rangan suggests remaining open may be the very defining quality of documentary, and that I too would assert going beyond the confines of the storybook house to the dream of the world house can make possibility real. Thank you.